Welcome to the Digital Tattoo Podcast Project. We're going to discuss a range of interconnected issues concerning academic research, open access, copyright law, and privacy within the setting of Canadian universities. The Digital Tattoo Project raises questions, provides examples, and links to resources that encourage you to think about your presence online, navigate the issues involved in forming and reforming your digital identity, and learn about your rights and responsibilities as a digital citizen. It's really just about making informed decisions and your own decisions. You can visit us at digitaltattoo.ubc.ca. We'll launch with the life of Aaron Schwartz, an open access advocate who took his own life in 2013 while facing a federal indictment for computer crimes after illegally downloading millions of articles from JSTOR. The politics of information have always existed and always will, but we are now involved in a process of drastic change. The present moment can be characterized as an information flood that is driven by cultures of the digital and the internet. The rapid changes brought on by this information revolution has led to an escalation in antagonistic information politics, with new figures surfacing to represent emerging social justice concerns. One of these individuals was Aaron Schwartz.
Yeah, so I co-founded a group called the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and what we try and do is we try and organize people over the internet who care about progressive politics and moving the country in a more progressive direction to kind of come together, join our email list, join our campaigns, and help get progressive candidates elected all across the country.
That's Schwartz speaking during an interview with Spun Out in 2010. Born in 1986, Schwartz was a passionate advocate for Knowledge Commons. He understood from a young age that knowledge is power, and that equitable, uninhibited access to information is a political issue. At a young age, Schwartz began developing coding skills and became active in web communities. By the age of 14, he had co-authored RSS, Rich Site Summary, which enables the syndication of information over the internet. At the age of 15, Schwartz collaborated with Lawrence Lessig to author Creative Commons, an alternative to copyright, which allows users to mark their creative products to indicate what freedoms of use they wish to grant to others. By 19, Schwartz was working on the team that developed Reddit. When Condé Nast bought Reddit, Schwartz made a fortune, but soon realized that his aspirations did not align with Silicon Valley's corporate culture. Schwartz involved himself in a fight for an internet grounded in human rights, connectivity, and creativity.
You know, feel very strongly that it's not enough to just live in the world as it is, to just kind of take what you're given and, you know, follow the things that adults told you to do and that, you know, your parents told you to do and that society tells you to do. I think you should always be questioning. You know, I take this very scientific attitude that everything you've learned is just provisional, that, you know, it's always open to recantation or refutation or questioning. And I think the same applies to society. And I, you know, felt growing up, you know, I slowly had this process of realizing that all the things around me that people had told me were just the natural way things were, the way things always would be. They weren't natural at all. They were things that could be changed, and they were things that, more importantly, were wrong and should change. And once I realized that, there was really kind of no going back. I couldn't fool myself into saying, oh, I'm just going to go work for a business and ignore all that. Once I realized that there were real serious problems, fundamental problems that I could do something to address, I didn't see a way to forget them.
This passion soon led him into serious legal trouble. In 2010, Schwartz illegally downloaded 4.8 million documents from the academic database JSTOR through MIT's electronic database subscription. While JSTOR incurred no losses resulting from his action and made the decision to drop charges against him, federal prosecutors were persistent in building an argument against Schwartz, based on the assumption that Schwartz had intended to violate copyright law by publishing the documents via peer-to-peer networks. On January 11, 2013, Aaron Schwartz took his own life at the age of 26. The tragedy took place in the midst of a daunting indictment by the United States federal prosecutor, who sought an exemplary conviction of 35 years in prison and up to $1 million in fines. Aaron face charges from computer fraud, electronic fraud, and unlawfully obtaining information, and recklessly damaging a protected computer. Schwartz's death was mourned internationally, sparking outrage and heated debates. It has been said that Aaron Schwartz was the first victim of the emerging cyber war on intellectual property, a war with many battles for the control and modulation of a global society in an informational context in which the value is increasingly being found in symbolic products and intangible goods.
You know, because I had believed so long that change was impossible, it precluded me from taking any actions that could have caused that change. And so I think the first step for everyone out there is just to believe that you can accomplish something.
The story of Aaron Schwartz leaves us with many questions. Questions which we hope to investigate through this podcast series. What crime did Aaron Schwartz commit by downloading all those documents from MIT's database? Why was this violation of copyright taken so seriously by federal prosecutors? Could this happen in Canada? We've decided to look into these questions within the context of our universities in Canada. We want to start by looking at copyright law, and then by looking at the open access revolution, which motivated Aaron Schwartz to take the actions that he did. How well do you understand the laws around copyright in Canada? As a university student, you deal with materials that are protected by international copyright on a daily basis. From the music you listen to the movies and shows that you watch, and the books and journal articles that you read, whether you know it or not, you are coming into contact with complex copyright negotiations on a daily basis through the ways that you're being educated and entertained. I talked to students at the University of British Columbia's Vancouver campus to find out what they know about copyright. All right, so to start with, what is copyright?
I understand that it means that someone can have ownership over an idea.
Copyright is cheating. Yeah, you just take somebody else's work and you copy it.
Well, you know, I loved when I came on board.
Yeah, that's my contribution.
I'm not actually sure. I don't actually have a definition. I mean, I know what it is. I know that it's material that's like legally belongs to a person or an entity that you need permission from to use. I don't know if that's a good definition, though.
It's a good definition.
Okay.
It's where big companies put in this restriction so you can't use their work unless you give them money.
And how often do you think about copyright on like a day-to-day basis?
This is the first time today. Yeah, so not really, you know.
And on normal days, you don't think about it at all?
I don't know why I would.
Almost all the time when I'm doing my essays and projects, because I don't want to be the one who actually copies without saying the name of the person who the source originally came from.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of always in my face because it shows up when you go to like JSTOR or whatever. The first page of your academic articles will always have like a copyright blurb just to remind you that, you know, this is an important thing and you can't, you know, reproduce it without the permission of the author or whomever.
It doesn't affect me very often on a day-to-day basis.
Most of us don't think about copyright because these contracts are negotiated for us. We subscribe to services like Apple Music and Netflix that license the music and shows that we consume directly from the creators. So we have a passive relationship with these contracts. That's because we as consumers are only indirectly connected to the creators, as our connections are mediated through distributors like Apple Music and Netflix. But what if we downloaded all of the music and all of the shows from these services and made them all freely available online for anyone to access? Would we be in violation of a contract with the copyright holder or with the distribution service? Or with both? Copyright?
You can be sued.
Do you know what happens if you were to break copyright?
Yeah, they'll send big lawyers, the MPA go after you, and then all the stuff like that, yeah.
I don't feel good myself. And I don't know what else happens. I actually don't know.
So like, it's a moral thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like, I don't like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose that because what you're doing is breaking the law, you could be in trouble. And I feel like that was what Metallica tried to do with Napster, because I'm of that vintage where Napster was really important for teaching me about legal rights and property and stuff. But yeah, for me, I don't know. I mean, I don't know anyone who's like gone to jail or who's been sued or anything over copyright personally. So for me, it seems like something kind of distant, and that it doesn't personally affect me, but I mean, I'm sure if I did something wrong publicly, it could become an issue.
So what happens if you do get caught downloading or sharing illegal files on a UBC system? Luckily, we don't have to guess, because there's a policy in place that governs the internet connections at UBC's student residences. It contains one particularly enlightening and exciting section titled Perils of Inappropriate Use. Quote, imagine your ResNet connection is suddenly shut down in the middle of the school term. Your network access that you depend on to do your assignments, as well as to communicate with your friends and to keep yourself entertained during off hours, is no longer there. When it will be turned on again is an open question. Before you have network access restored, a letter about your failure to abide by community standards, or worse, could be sent to your dean or department head. There may even be more serious consequences involving the University Legal Affairs Office and the RCMP. Finally, you may have to pay a fee of $75 or more to reactivate your ResNet connection. And you may not even know that your computer was involved in anything wrong. None of this is far-fetched. It has happened to students in your residence. There has even been a case, for example, of a student distributing pirated MP3 audio files across the internet. His computer was located by an agency for the copyright holder. The agent's sole job is to find just such illegal files. The copyright holder can take the university to court because of those files on that student's computer. The student's ResNet connection was shut down. End quote. All right, all jokes and effects aside, what does happen in Canada when the average person downloads something that they perhaps shouldn't have? We already know what happened to Aaron Schwartz when he downloaded millions of journal articles from JSTOR in the United States. But what about in Canada? How does our system work? In Canada, we have a system called Notice and Notice, which requires internet service providers to forward copyright infringement notices to users. This leads to people receiving emails that often threaten legal prosecution and demand payment for alleged offenses. To find out a little bit more about how Notice and Notice works, we spoke with Michael Geist, the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-Commerce at the University of Ottawa, and an expert on copyright law.
And the basic idea behind it is that where a rights holder identifies what they believe to be an act of infringement, let's say they allege someone's downloaded a movie or a song or some piece of content in an unauthorized fashion, they have the IP address, but they don't necessarily know who the person is. They've got the ability to send a notification on to the relevant internet provider, who now under the law has an obligation to forward on that notification to the relevant subscriber. That's as far as notice goes, although it's open to the rights holder to take it further. So for example, they could in theory say, I'm not satisfied just with the notification, I actually want to go ahead and sue this person for infringement.
Let's turn for a moment and have a look at some of the notices that UBC students have received from copyright holders and that have been forwarded to students by the university, which acts as an internet service provider on campus. We found a few stories on Reddit, the website created in part by Schwartz, about UBC students who have received copyright infringement notices from UBC IT. One student said that they were sent an email that demanded a settlement fee of $150. The notice that UBC IT forwarded to the student included information about the content that allegedly violated copyright, the date and time of the alleged offense, and provided a link where the student could pay the settlement fee. The company that sent the infringement notice was not the copyright holder itself, but a third party that's contracted to specifically extort money from alleged offenders. The UBC student in this case referred to the tactic as copyright trolling and didn't pay the fine. But others have fallen for the ploy and then been extorted for more money, according to the stories we've read on Reddit. I asked Mr. Geist if this was a potential flaw in the notice and notice system, this method of extorting Canadians into paying settlement fees for alleged offenses.
It certainly is. And in fact, it's something that was not intended, I don't think, certainly by the government or those who were involved in the process. This had been in place for almost a decade before it took formal effect. And it really was used and designed primarily for education purposes, so that people would know about these things. It was not used to try to pressure people into engaging in settlements based on the fact that someone's made an allegation. I think, unfortunately, the government pushed this into effect without adopting specific regulations that might have restricted what rights holders or anti-piracy companies can put in the notifications. That isn't what was intended with the system. And there is, I think, some hope, indeed I'd go so far as to say there is some expectation, that the government, when it reviews the Copyright Act, if not sooner, will do what should have been done in the first place, which is to put some rules and restrictions around how the system is used so that this kind of misuse and abuse doesn't happen.
I then asked Mr. Geist if internet service providers like UBC are complicit in this extortion by forwarding the requests to users.
No network provider who's subject to the system really has much choice. There is potential liability in the thousands of dollars for each notification that isn't forwarded, unless there's a good reason for having not forwarded it. So ISPs have been put in, network providers more generally have been put in a difficult position. They really don't have much alternative but to forward along the notification. One of the issues is, to what extent can they advise or notify their users that they're not required to settle? And I think some providers and network providers have been trying to push the envelope a little bit, or at least, frankly, making a best efforts to try to educate, which I think they're totally within their rights to do. One thing that some have been doing has been pointing subscribers two specific web pages that are run by the government that leave no doubt that there is no obligation to settle. So I think there are some things that can be done to try to educate, but not everybody reads through, much less clicks through, in some of those notifications. And we know that there are many instances where people, in a bit of a panic, click through the site, pay up, and settle when there's no obligation to do so.
UBC, for their part, includes this message with all the copyright infringement notices that they forward to students. Quote, UBC has received a notice that alleges an act of copyright infringement from an IP address that is assigned to you or that UBC reasonably believes was used by you at the time the alleged infringement occurred. The unaltered notice is set out below. You'll note that it contains the time of the alleged infringement and the content that was allegedly copied. Having received an infringement notice, the Copyright Act requires UBC to do three things. 1. Forward the infringement notice to you. 2. Notify the person who sent the notice that UBC has forwarded the notice to you. 3. Retain this record for 6 months or 12 months if court proceedings are commenced. Important points. The content owner likely does not know your identity. UBC has not provided your identity or contact information to the contact owner and will not do so unless required to by a court order or other legal process. It is content owners who monitor the use of IP addresses to determine whether their copyright has been infringed. UBC is not involved in the process. UBC does not evaluate the legitimacy of the notices it receives from content owners. UBC merely forwards the notices it has received, as is required by law. UBC does not endorse or support the allegation described in the notice. You are not required to respond to the notice. The notice sets out the content owner's position, but only a court ruling may determine your liability. It is the content owner's decision whether to take additional steps to enforce their rights. Many notices cite the law of other jurisdictions, most commonly U.S. law, where the law would require you or the digital network provider to take down the allegedly infringing material. Such laws do not apply in Canada. For more information about the notice and notice provisions, visit, and here UBC provides links to a copyright website that's created internally, or Industry Canada's website. For more information about your rights and obligations under copyright law, visit copyright.ubc.ca. Unquote. Based on the information that UBC includes in its communications with students, the university is doing a good job in providing students with the resources they need to make decisions about the validity and legality of allegations made against them by copyright holders. It's also worth noting that UBC, as an internet service provider, is, according to the Copyright Act, required by law to forward these communications to users. The Copyright Act is going under review this year. I asked Mr. Geis what he expects to see changed.
Well, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of things that might be on the table. The government just moved forward with a specific consultation on the copyright board. And so I think it seems fairly clear that they will move on the copyright board even before they move on the Copyright Act. In terms of other issues, there is everything from fair dealing to whether or not we need a fair use provision to any number of other copyright issues have been on the table for some time. I think this notice and notice issue is certainly one of the issues that, if it's not addressed before then, will take up a considerable amount of time and will be part of the copyright review. And because it really wasn't what was intended, I think it's certainly reasonable to project, indeed expect, that the government will take steps to put forward the regulations that should have been put forward in the first place, and to ensure that the way the system is used is the way it was intended to be used, as an education tool, not as an attempt to misuse the law and try to obtain settlement.
Recently, the notion of fair dealing in higher education has been significantly confused in Canadian law. This summer, York University lost a case against Access Copyright, a collective that provides access to a collection of copyright-protected materials and distributes royalties to creators. In 2011, York University decided to stop paying money to Access Copyright because they believed they were spending too much on royalties and instead decided to deal with intellectual property rights on their own. As long as the materials that York University used were considered fair dealing under Canadian law, they were okay to use copyrighted materials and not pay any money to the creators or copyright holders. So York University created a document that outlined how faculty and staff could use these materials and went about business as usual. But now a federal court judge has said that this document outlined a means of distributing copyright materials that weren't fair at all. Section 29 of the Copyright Act reads, "Fair dealing for the purpose of research, private study, education, parody, or satire does not infringe on copyright." Section 29.1 outlines that fair dealing for the purpose of criticism or review does not infringe on copyright if the following are mentioned: A, the source, and B, if given a source, the name of the 1. Author in the case of the work, 2. Performer in the case of a performer's performance, 3. The maker in the case of a sound recording, or 4. Broadcaster in the case of a communication signal. The federal court ruling has thrown into question not just the way that York University has interpreted this section of the Copyright Act, but how universities across Canada are supposed to understand what's fair and not fair when it comes to fair dealing. I asked Mr. Geist about what this recent ruling means for Canadian universities.
Well, we've seen in the last number of years a dramatic shift in the way students obtain materials and in the way in which faculty make those materials available. Now, Access Copyright was a longstanding copyright collective that has paid for or sought payment for various uses on campus, arguing that the certain copying that takes place should be compensated, has been looking for a university, continue that approach and wanting universities and by extension their students to pay annual fees for that copying. Many universities have stopped paying the fee, stopped with the license on the grounds that all of these other mechanisms for obtaining content really have removed the need for an access copyright license, and part of that is fair dealing, but by no means exclusively so. Access Copyright challenged that approach in one instance with York University, and at the trial level was successful, with the judge, in my respectful view, badly misinterpreting the law as it's been articulated by the Supreme Court of Canada in any number of ways, to rule that what York was doing was not fair dealing. That case is going to be appealed. York University has indicated that it plans to appeal. And it would appear that the general approach of universities across the country is to continue with the kind of balanced approach that draws on a number of different mechanisms for obtaining content, the majority of which are paid ways, so that creators and publishers are ultimately paid, and then some of which do involve fair dealing. It looks like people are going to continue with those policies, and I think in many ways turn their attention to the Federal Court of Appeal, where this Access Copyright York University case will ultimately head.
Perhaps now is a good time to mention that none of the people who work at UBC in the Copyright Office are available to comment. This is because the university could go in two very different directions in the next month. The next question I asked Mr. Geis was about the renegotiation of NAFTA with the United States. Our Copyright Act has been identified by the U.S. as one of the areas of central concern, likely because of some of the issues that we've already discussed, like how our laws protect the personal information of Canadians from being sent to copyright holders in the United States.
Yeah, I think it's likely to be an issue. I mean, intellectual property chapter has already been identified by the United States as one of their areas of concern. And so it seems likely, if history is any precedent, that they will raise this issue again. That could, if we look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, mean that we will see issues such as copyright term extension, the term of copyright, be an issue that's raised. There may well be attempts to try to lock down or lock in certain approaches, any circumvention rules, the so-called digital lock rules, where there's a fair amount of flexibility at the international level, but we may see efforts to try to require Canada to adopt rules that are more restrictive than what's otherwise found within international treaties. We might see efforts to try to embed that within NAFTA as well. So in the short answer, you know, that wasn't the short answer, is yes. I think it's very likely that copyright will be part of the discussion, and I think, and a bit discouraging, but I think it's certainly in the realm of possibility, if not likely, that as part of the various trade-offs that are made in the discussions, copyright gets lost a little bit in the shuffle.
And lastly, I asked Mr. Geis what part copyright played in fueling the open access revolution.
I think the source of open access and its increasing acceptance and widespread use is partially fueled by copyright, frustration with copyright rules, and especially the contracts that are required by publishers who often create restrictions on the very work that users have and professors and researchers have created. I don't think it's limited to that. I think that that many academics and researchers, they write under a different incentive system. They aren't looking to be paid for their work per se. They believe they are already fairly compensated, and they want to ensure that their work is as broadly disseminated as possible. In a sense, that's the currency that is really relevant for them.
We're out of time on this episode of the Digital Tattoo Podcast Project, but we're not done our discussion on copyright and open access yet. On the next episode, I'll speak with a Canadian lawyer who practices intellectual property law. We'll dive a little deeper into the life of Aaron Schwartz, and I'll ask the editors of the University of Toronto's medical journal why open access is so important to them. The Digital Tattoo Podcast Project is hosted and produced by me, Brian Short. It was recorded at the UBC Graduate School of Journalism. The introduction to the life of Aaron Schwartz was written by Margot Smith. This episode also features music by Lee Rosevere and was modified for this recording. The Digital Tattoo Project is a collaboration between the UBC Library, the Irving K. Barber Learning Center, UBC Center for Teaching, Learning, and Technology, and the University of Toronto's iSchool and U of T libraries. For more information about these issues or to leave a comment, please visit digitaltattoo.ubc.ca.